Eufy is sponsoring today's video. They reached out to me. I tested out their video lock. It is a game changer. I'm going to paint a picture for you for why I'm so excited to work with them. So you're getting home, your arms are loaded with groceries or packages or boxes or everything, and your keys are in your pocket. This drives me nuts. This happens all the time. I upgraded to the Eufy video lock, fingerprint, tap, I'm inside. And honestly, I also feel way safer. It's got this awesome built-in camera. So whether it's a package delivery or late night Uber order, I see exactly who's there right from my phone. There are no more mystery knocks. And the best part, this thing was such a breeze to set up. There's no wires, there's no drilling. There's also no monthly subscription fees. So if you are done fumbling with your keys, because I definitely am, search for Eufy Video Lock or head over to eufyofficial.com/video lock. Your front door, your sanity. I just want to take a second and thank Policy Genius. They're supporting today's episode of Success Story. I know we all have kids. We all have families we want to take care of. And I personally checked something off major on my to-do list, life insurance. It's a tough topic. It's really hard to think about, but it's so important. And the hard part was sorting through all the options. Luckily, I found Policy Genius. Policy Genius is an online insurance marketplace that makes getting life insurance surprisingly easy. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. Now, knowing my family's protected brings me incredible peace of mind. Don't put off this important decision. Check life insurance off your to-do list in no time with Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com or click the link in the description to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com. What do you recommend for companies to sort of stay ahead of the curve?
Depending on their areas of operation, what jurisdictions they're working in, and the size of the company, that can change. But you have to understand, if you're running a business, small, medium, large, doesn't matter. You gotta have...
Michael Baker is a former CIA covert operations officer, president of Diligence LLC, a global intelligence firm, and the host Black Files Declassified.
That book is called Company Rules. Everything I know about business I learned from the CIA. But it's not like you get a manual when you sit down for the first day of training and they say, here's the company rules. These were things that I took away. There's 9, in fact. And there's 9 because I couldn't think of the 10th. So, but there's little things like...
What's the one thing that you really fucked up when you were building a business? So what is it? Welcome to Success Story. I'm your host, Scott Clary. The Success Story podcast is part of the HubSpot podcast network. They've been supporting the show for over 2 years now. And when it comes to running an incredible business, HubSpot's got your back. Now, if you're an entrepreneur, you know that nothing matters more than generating revenue, but salespeople aren't just closing deals. They're tracking down leads. They're forecasting growth. They're whipping up reports, managing contacts, creating content, crunching numbers. The list of tasks goes on and on. With Q4 around the corner, there's a better way to win. It all starts with the new HubSpot Sales Hub. Now, with the HubSpot Sales Hub, your data, tools, and teams are fully linked inside a smart and highly customizable platform that feels good to use. It's easy. Turn prospects into pipeline and close your deals all in one place. Plus, sequences and smooth workflows help reps streamline tasks and spend more time on what they do best, connecting with customers. With Sales Hub, closing big deals is simple. Try it for yourself at HubSpot.com/sales.
That thing, that moment in time, would have been when I had my last interview to get into the agency, into the CIA. And the fellow who was kind of doing that last in-person interview, and I had, you know, I'd been talking to them for a while. They had, you know, there's a lot of back and forth, and you never really know where you stand. And anyway, so we had this last interview, and he was a very highly regarded sort of traditional Cold War era spy officer within the agency, very well regarded and a really storied career. So I'm sitting there in my little chair and he's sitting behind his big desk and he's looking at my file, and the file seemed awful large since I didn't actually work there at the time. And so he's leafing through it, and And I'm thinking, oh, God, now what? And it's deadly quiet, and, you know, which is a good interrogation technique, right? I mean, if you just leave the silence there and people are inclined to talk, so don't feel like you got to fill up all the space. And so he wasn't. He was just staring at my file. And then he looked at me down at his nose, and he had those little half glasses on, and he said, basically, he said, you have the lowest GPA of anybody we've ever recruited into the operations directorate. And I had no idea what to say to that. I figured he was right. Because I knew how awful my GPA was coming out of university. And I looked at him and I said, well, I guess that makes me a winner. And he stared at me for a while, I think waiting for me to say something else. And I had nothing to say at that point. So I stared at him. Finally, he stood up and shook my hand and said, welcome. And that set me off on a tremendous ride with the agency, which I'm always, always grateful for that experience. And it also taught me that, you know, that I had more ability, more skills than I think just the book learning or the GPA would imply. And that was a real moment, right? Because that gave me sort of an immense boost of confidence that then allowed me to go in and do what I did with the agency, which gives you a tremendous amount of responsibility at a relatively young age. So that was, I would say, that's that point in time when I really knew that I was going to be on the right path.
So I was speaking to a Navy SEAL, Kaj Larson, and he was telling me that he wanted to be a SEAL because he watched too much Top Gun growing up. So I'm super curious. Was it like too much Tom Clancy or what? What got you into this?
No, I didn't. You know, I didn't really anticipate that's where I was going to end up. It wasn't like I had some lifelong dream ever since I was a kid. In fact, I still have a little one page on lined paper, you know, from elementary school days. I think I was in, I don't know, I might have been, it was before I got the first form. So it was probably, 10 years old. And it was talking about what you wanted to be when you grew up. And my answer was I wanted to be an astronaut. And my fallback position was if I couldn't be an astronaut, I wanted to be a police officer. And so I had no real, you know, passion. It wasn't like I thought this is what I have to do with my life. And so it's interesting, but it turns out that it was a pretty solid fit.
It worked out. You said 17 out. Years, right?
Yeah, 17 years. Yeah, almost 20 by the time we wrapped it up.
Oh shit. So what is the, you know, I'm super curious, and you stop when you have to stop, but what's the process of training and what's the process of onboarding? And because like that seems to be an incredible amount of responsibility to give a kid coming out of college, university. Mm-hmm. So there has to be significant.
It depends
training.
On what you're doing. There's the interesting thing about the agency is that there's a number of what we used to call directorates. They're basically the, you know, elements within the organization that focus on different things: science and technology, intel analysis, which is where all the really smart people go to write, you know, the material up that gets collected off the streets, the operations side, where I was, and an admin, which is critically important to what the agency does. And so, you know, it kind of depends. It's horses for courses, right? Everybody goes in and they've got a different training path and they come in from a different, you know, past experience. But the onboarding, you know, and I tell people this all the time, young people all the time who, you know, talk to me about what the experiences are going to be like or, you know, how they apply, what do they do. The onboarding can be a very lengthy and difficult process, right? Because mm-hmm. of the nature of what the agency is. So you have to be extremely patient. You have to be committed, right? And you have to be definite about what it is that you want to do. If you just go to the agency and say, I'd like to apply, nowadays you can apply online and say, I'd like to apply because I want to, I don't know, be a spy. Or I want to work for the state. You have to, they're looking for something a little bit more defined than that. They're looking for people with commitment, with self-discipline, motivated by things other than money, obviously, because it's a government job. If I told you what my starting salary was, you'd probably, you know, send me a bag of money. But it is a, it's worth it in the end, right? For the right people, for when it's the right fit, it's a tremendous experience.
That's odd. And you know, what is the right person for that kind of job? How do you know growing up that you could be the right person? And then you think about what's the right person for CIA versus FBI? What's the different personality type?
It is definitely a different personality type, right? It's not, there's not a lot of similarities between working for an intel operation and working in law enforcement, right?
Correct.
But I think there probably are some traits that cut across, you know, both of those areas. And I would say, again, self-discipline would be one of those things, self-starter, motivated, patriotic, that always helps. But with the agency, look, they're looking for people who can work independently, but who can work as team members, right? You got to play well with others. And there's also a sense of, I don't want to call it curiosity, inquisitiveness. It's more of an awareness and concern and interest in what's happening in the world, right? If you sit down and start talking to a recruiter and you don't know what's happening around the world in some detail, then that's going to show a lack of awareness and you know, understanding, right? And the work of the agency is overseas, so that's a part of it. Your ability to do languages is a key part of the agency's operations, of course, because so much, I mean, everything we do is focused externally. So it's, you know, and that then there's other bits and pieces that can fall into there. You got to keep your nose clean, right?
Yeah.
They still do lifestyle polygraphs. Right? If you show up and you've been doing recreational drugs during the course of your college career or, you know, shortly thereafter, yeah, that door's closed, right? Even though they know it's a new day. So if you, you know, smoked a, you know, bit of weed in you know, beginning of college, okay. But the honest to God's truth is they got a very deep well of potential candidates.
Yeah, and so they don't even bother.
They don't even bother, yeah. I mean, even though they know the world has changed and is changing, again, they're looking for those people who demonstrate through their lifestyle that they're disciplined.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because a lot of people listening to this would think, like, why wouldn't they evolve? And there is so many candidates. I have firsthand experience from this because my dad used to work for CSIS. So I'm Canadian. So, I mean, it's very different, obviously, but not that different in terms of their hiring and onboarding and what they're looking for and the strict policies they have. And it's just because, I mean, it's just the type of work you do. I feel like you don't want to let anyone have anything on you when you're going into this kind of work. Like, it's easier to do the job when you go in clean, and then that it's already going to be tough enough. Right. So I know that they've had really tough hiring policies in CSIS, which is like a similar type organization in Canada. But
Absolutely. Yeah. And the UK's operations are the same. And really any serious minded intel service is going to feel the same way. Yeah. You don't want to, I mean, why start with somebody who has already demonstrated, you know, the potential to be compromised, right? In a sense.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I tell young folks that all the time, just keep your nose clean, you know, figuratively.
And literally.
Yeah. And then it's all those other things, you know, study languages, get proficient at ideally something other than Spanish or French, even though those are great languages, but hard languages are always going to be desired. It can be a journey, right? I know a lot of young folks who applied, great credentials. You know, after the first year, they're still waiting to find out whether they've been accepted or are they going to get through the next round of interviews. And eventually, you know, you got to pay the bills. So they do lose, you know, very good candidates because sometimes the process is very arduous.
And what kind of personal life can you have during your career? For security and clearance reasons or otherwise, just the travel, the type of lifestyle that you have. I guess it really depends on the deployment that you're given.
Yeah, it really is depends on the path or the career path that you're following, right? There are people that work for the agency that, you know, are based all the time in headquarters or, you know, somewhere else in a main facility of the organization. And then there are others who, you know, spend your life overseas. I spent basically all my time. I never did a headquarters tour. I spent all my time overseas. And, you know, for the right person, I grew up overseas. I lived overseas. I spent most of my life there. I enjoyed it. I'm very comfortable. And that's what I was looking for. So, you know, it just depends, right? But you've got to want something other than, recognition, right? Again, it's not the money and it's not the pat on the back. If you're somebody who has to be constantly pat on the back and told you're doing a great job, then you probably need to look elsewhere for employment.
Yeah. And you know, then, you know, we have to fast forward 20 years, but then the question becomes, when do you choose to exit at a career like this, and how do you? Because you've exited out of a career like this, but then you become, you know, you're putting out a book, you go on TV, you're going on Rogan, like you're not keeping a low profile. So how do you come to that decision? That's obviously, first of all, you're not just exiting, which is already difficult enough. You're exiting and then building a personal brand around yourself.
Yeah. I mean, it's more of the fact that I built a company, started and built a company. And so that's where a lot of the sort of the external activities, the media appearances and all that, because I was looking for a way to get free marketing for my business that I was starting up.
You're damn smart. That's the way to do it, man.
I couldn't pay for it. And I talk about it in the book that I just came out with on Scribd, the Netflix of books, Scribd. It's an audio book, so it's an easy read. But I talk about that moment when I decided I have to leave. And I left for, you know, very simple reasons. I was raising a daughter, and I needed to be home. And I needed to be at least home more often. And as it turns out, kids don't really care what you do for a living as long as you're there sitting on the floor playing Legos. Or in my case, watching endless Disney videos. So I remember I had to go and make that decision. It was easier because I had a great boss at the time. Who was very senior within the operations group and was a terrifically understanding and generous individual. And then had some other good folks there, and they really went to bat for me. And they said, "Look," because I was too young to retire. I wasn't retiring. I was leaving. Which everyone thought was stupid, because I was basically throwing away all that time built up for pension or retirement, whatever you want to call it. So that just got chucked out the window because I, you know, was leaving.
You don't have your whatever, your 70% of your five best years or whatever the hell the pension is.
Yeah, exactly. So that went out the window. So people thought I was being enormously stupid. They kept asking me what it was that I was going to do. I didn't really have an idea. Was very fortunate that I had a very good friend of mine who came out of the British teams. We'd known each other for a while, and he wanted to do the same thing. And he was with by that time he was with the British service, one of them, and he wanted to leave. And we decided to kind of strike out. We got lucky, both getting brought into a startup in the intelligence and investigations and security services industry, which is kind of the only thing I could think of that aligned with the skills that I had. And so we had a lot of luck right at the outset. And, you know, I, looking back on it, and I talk about this, I think in the book, is that I never was engaged in an operation that worked, that didn't have some element of luck, right? You'd like to think it's all because you're so fucking clever, but it primarily, there was always some little bit of luck that came in there and influenced the outcome.
I was, when you pivot into private, you're building a company in the intelligence space. It's, you know, it's interesting because you had a behind the curtains view at a lot of the darkest spots of the world, but you can't bring that into the private industry. So you have to separate and delineate those two lives, basically. Yeah. So when you do that, because in theory that could even be a competitive advantage for private industry. So how do you build something and, you know, former, you know, boss is not concerned about what you're building, about who you're consulting for, about the information, that you know, you're giving these companies. What's the offboarding process like?
Yeah, when we got started, there wasn't a lot of this going on, right? You didn't have a lot of movement from the Intel community, whether it was in here or the UK or wherever, into the private sector. Not that I'm, as old as Wilford Brimley, but it was a while back. And so we didn't really know, I think, at the time what we were getting into, which is why we were so fortunate. There's this fellow that I mentioned who hired us at the outset. He really kind of acted as a mentor and allowed us to set the table. And we knew we wanted to have our own gig. I mean, there was no question about that. We wanted to have our own business. And I think that came out of the fact, certainly for me, that the agency, the CIA, does give you so much responsibility. That my theory is, once you've been there, particularly in the operations side, if you've worked overseas in operations for a long period of time, you would make the world's worst employee anywhere else, right? You would be a terrible employee, and I knew I would be. So I knew that I had to have my own business at some point, and my buddy Nick felt the same way. So we had a chance, to understand what the investigations intel security services business was like in the private sector by working with Mike Comer in the UK. We were based out of London, and that was both lucky and enormously helpful. Yeah. So from there, we were able to then start our own business and build that over the years. But the agency I've always had a good relationship with because I respect them immensely. Yeah. I respect the people I worked for. I keep my yap shut when it comes to, all the important things.
I know a lot of entrepreneurs listen to this show, and NetSuite has been a huge supporter for entrepreneurs, for business owners, because there's one thing that we all know. Business is about making money, and it's about your bottom line. And the less you spend on the nuts and bolts of running your business, the more profits you keep. But these days, everything is costing more. Supplies, people, shipping. It squeezes your margins, and I've been there, juggling multiple systems for finance, inventory, you name it. Each with its own costs and its own set of headaches. That's why I made the switch to NetSuite by Oracle. It's changed our company. Think about it. NetSuite is one of the top financial systems out there. It puts your whole business on one platform, accounting, finance, the works. One data source for everyone. There's no more mismatched info. And because it's in the cloud, it slashes your IT costs. No more servers, no more updates. Just access NetSuite from anywhere. With one integrated suite, your overhead drops big time. And here's the real win. Efficiency. Everything's connected in NetSuite. Costs are ridiculous lately. Find a proven way to reduce your expenses and get better performance out of your team. It's a no-brainer, and that's what NetSuite offers. Over 37,000 companies have figured this out already. You have to join them. Right now, through to April 15th, NetSuite's got an incredible, flexible financing plan. Check it out and see the savings yourself at netsuite.com/ScottClary. That's netsuite.com/ScottClary. I don't know about you, but the idea of being harassed, scammed, or even worse, all because somebody found my personal information online, that's terrifying. Our political opinions, our addresses, even stuff about our families, it's out there for anyone to grab. And did you know that data brokers are allowed to sell information on over 98% of Americans? It's scary stuff. That's why I've partnered with Delete Me. I personally use Delete Me. They're a big friend of the podcast because I put myself out there online. So safety is a huge concern. It's really scary how easy it is to find someone's details and information, but Delete Me creates a layer of protection that we all need. You tell Delete Me what you want gone, and they make it disappear from those sketchy data broker sites. And Delete Me doesn't stop. They constantly monitor the web to keep your information off those lists. It's like having a privacy watchdog that never sleeps. You need to take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me. They're giving a special discount for all Success Story podcast listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/success and use promo code success at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/success and enter code success at checkout. joindeleteme.com/success. Hey everyone, I just want to take a second and thank the sponsor of today's episode, Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond Bourbon. Now, I don't have a lot of liquor sponsors on this show. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is actually one of my favorites. I've drank it for a few years now, and this is why we actually decided to work together. Heaven Hill Distillery, family-owned since 1935, is a great entrepreneur story, too. So there's five brothers. They filled their first whiskey barrels back in 1935, and their legacy still lives on today. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is aged over 7 years. That's three more than required by the Bottled and Bond Act of 1897. This means the best quality, the best purity, and the best consistency. This is not just average bourbon. It's the winner of the double gold medals at multiple 2023 World Spirits competitions, and they've won the very prestigious Triple Still Award. It's a very big deal in the liquor and bourbon world. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond boasts an exceptionally smooth oak flavor, while its aroma offers a sweet blend of caramel and smooth vanilla. If you love bourbon, you need to try Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond. Available nationally, look for a bottle at your local store. Heaven Hill reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely. Think back to your last few days in the office. Did any of them leave you feeling really accomplished? Not the kind of day where you're running around like crazy, but where you've made real progress on something that matters. Because being busy doesn't always mean being productive, and I bet you we've all been there, and maybe it's time to rethink what it means to get things done. Today's episode is sponsored by Belay, and what they help you do is, instead of getting sucked into emails and to-do lists, they help you delegate tasks and focus on big goals. They can connect you with top-notch US-based talent who are ready to take on those time-consuming tasks that bog you down. Let's be real, there are way more important things you could be doing than bookkeeping or wrangling a packed inbox. They have virtual assistants to handle all of those pesky administrative tasks, or accounting professional to take care of all your financials. But here's the best part. You don't have to waste weeks searching for the right person. Belay's personalized matching service works quickly, sometimes matching you with the right talent to take stuff off your plate in under a week. Are you ready to try a different way of working? Check out Belay's list of the top 25 things you can delegate to a virtual assistant. It might just change your business and your life. Text SUCCESS, that's SUCCESS, to 55123 to get the list and to start transforming your to-do list with Belay. Thank you so much, Indeed, for sponsoring Success Story. For all business leaders out there, Indeed is a lifesaver. See, we're always driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. You're going to ditch the busy work and you're going to use Indeed for scheduling, screening, messaging, so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Clary. Just go to Indeed.com/Clary right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Clary. Terms and conditions apply. If you need to hire, you need Indeed.
Yeah. And, you know, I never felt like, you know, some people leave an organization, doesn't matter what the organization is, yeah, and they feel like they didn't get enough hugs or they weren't respected. And so, you know, they always, or that if the organization had just listened to them, things would have been different. I never felt that way. You know, I was out in the field. I was on the street. I did, you know, the tasks. And I think in a simple-minded way, that's why I was a good fit, because I never sat around and stared at my belly button and wondered where I fit in the whole, you know, scheme of things and, you know, all the questions that can come from working for an Intel organization.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And as you build this up, you know, you mentioned something, being in the agency probably makes you the worst employee in the world, but it also made you a successful entrepreneur. So I'm curious about, and I think this is probably what allowed you to actually write this book. So what were some of the things that you learned while being in the agency that allowed you to be successful? Because there's always these traits to carry over. And I find it fascinating between sports and business. And I've never really thought about, you know, agency life and business, but there's a lot of parallels there too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is, you know, I'd been asked about, well, you want to write a book about your over the years, about your time with the agency. And I was like, no. A, I don't think anybody would ever want to read it. And B, you know, I don't see any need for it. And other people are doing that, and that's fine. But then after a while, you know, it became clear that one of the things that was interesting to me was that there were certain things I did learn from my time with the agency. I don't even know that I knew I was absorbing those ideas or principles at the time that allowed, you know, me to get out and build a company and keep it, you know, moving forward, hopefully, still to this day. And so I think look, these things, I refer, the book is called Company Rules, right? Company Rules, everything I know about business I learned from the CIA. But there's no set of company rules. It's not like you get a manual when you sit down for the first day of training and they say, here's the company rules. But these were things that I took away. You know, I know guys that I worked with, people that I worked with, they left. I'm sure they took away their own ideas, but these happened to be mine. And there's a variety of them in there. There's nine, in fact. And there's nine because I couldn't think of a tenth. So, and I didn't want to just make shit up. So, but there's little things like define the mission, right? And that sounds simplistic, but when you join the agency, one of the first things that happens is you spend what seems like an ungodly amount of time sitting in like a windowless classroom for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, listening to people bang on about the structure of the organization and the structure of the intel community and the structure of its place in the world and the world itself and how all these pieces link together. And you don't realize it necessarily at the time, but what they're trying to do is they're trying to define the mission. They're trying to explain to you, you know, who you're working for, because most people show up without really having a full understanding, obviously. Yeah. And what your purpose is and what the agency's purpose is in life. And that's critically important. And so I do the same thing in business. What I've found over the years is, A, you got to hire people smarter than yourself, right? People hear that all the time. It's a kind of a trite saying. For me, it's easy because I can find lots of people smarter than me. So, but you have to hire people smarter than yourself. And then what I found most effective is just define the mission. And the mission may be just for a particular project. Here's the project. The mission is not, okay, we have a company and the company wants to make money. You know, that's a shitty mission statement. But the mission can be, what do we want to be? We want to be the finest intelligence, investigative, and security services firm in the world. Okay, you know, now you're getting closer to a mission statement. But the mission statement can also be for just specific projects for clients. Here it is. And I'll explain that to a team leader who's got a staff of people who are going to work on a project. You explain the mission, you make sure they understand it, then you get the hell out of the way, right? And then you count on the fact that you've hired the right people. And so in our case, at Portman Square Group, we try to hire smart, curious people who speak multiple languages, who are great at research and investigation, at eliciting information, solid at writing. And then you stay out of their way and you let them do the job. And that's one of those things that I took away from the agency. Other little things, you know, like knowing your operating environment. That is fairly self-explanatory from an operational perspective, right? If you're operating in a hostile or challenging environment, you better know what the hell you're stepping into, right? And the agency has always been very good about that. The best managers, the best officers, when they get new people coming into their area of operations, give them time, right, to understand the environment, to understand, get out, really just understand where you're working in, right? Get out there and get a feel for it before you get started doing whatever it is you're going to be doing. And in business, it's, you know, it's pretty much the same. Know your operating environment. I mean, that means everything from, you know your competition, know your potential clients, know your shareholders, your investors.
Yeah.
Understand the jurisdictions you're operating in and what the limitations are there. So there's all these little things. And there's a series of these ideas. Again, I don't know that I was even aware I was absorbing them. But eventually, you know, a while back in a conversation, someone said, well, you should put all this down in a book. And so we did. And, you know.
There are a lot of parallels. I think what's most fascinating when I look at your life in the agency versus your life as an entrepreneur, founder, business owner, when you have to, for example, define your mission in the agency or know your operating environment in the agency, if you do not properly define your mission, people can die. If you do not properly know your operating environment, people can die. In a business, there's a lot of times when people try to define a mission, but they don't properly do it. And no one dies. Maybe the business dies, but nobody actually dies. They just work half-assed, or they work without guidance for months at a time, and they waste a lot of money, and they, you know, they bullshit around and whatnot. So I guess when you come from such a like a high pressure environment where it's very black and white, there can be no margin of error because it's a very high risk environment in some of these cases. How do you take that, and how do you have the same level of information landing with your team that you would get? You understand what I'm saying?
No, I do. It's a really good question. It's a really smart question. It's you know what, if you really don't care about your business, or you really don't care about your clients, then it's supposed to fine, fuck it. You know, I'm just gonna, you know, here it is, let's see how it goes, and maybe we make some money and, you know, live to see another day. But when it's your own business, and I know a lot of your folks are, you know, entrepreneurs and you know, they've started or have started or are process of building their own businesses, it's really a different situation, right? Every day it's you. Every day it's your reputation. No matter how big the company gets, you are, at least I feel, so personally invested in the work product that goes out the door and how our clients feel about it. And we work for a lot of Fortune 50 companies and large law firms and financial institutions and others. And I worry all the time, excessively so, about, you know, whether we're doing the best job we can for them. And I know that sounds trite, but honest to God, it's the truth. I stress more about whether the clients, and I've worked with some of these companies now for, you know, a decade and a half or longer, and, you know, they're very good friends. And so maybe that puts more pressure on, because now you're working for friends.
Yeah, totally.
Not just some company. So you try to impart that to the folks that are working with you, right? And that's tough. If you're talking about, like, you know, younger folks, they've just come on board or whatever, they're not going to be as invested. They're not going to be as concerned. They're not going to stress about things. But we've been lucky. We've got people that have been with me now for over 15 years, right? Which is a little unusual in this industry. You get a lot of staff movement typically. But we've had people that have stuck with us for a long time, and they do feel that same level of stress or pressure. And I think that's important, because it sets you apart, right? I've taken on projects, large projects, multi-jurisdictional issues, where we just haven't been getting a result, right? Because you're doing everything you can, and you're just not finding the answer. You're not getting that piece of intelligence, or you're not seeing the evidence that you know, points to some sort of solution. And you know, there have been times when I've said, screw it, we're not going to bill you anymore, because we're not producing right now. We're just going to keep working. And, you know, so I not that I'm the world's worst business person, but there have been times when I've been operating almost as a nonprofit because I want the right result. So I've never had a problem. I've been very lucky. People sometimes get out of the agency and they spend the rest of their time talking about their time in the agency, right?
Yeah.
I loved it. But what I also love is I got a great new challenge when I got out and started in the private sector and started building a business. And I get a tremendous charge out of it still. So I've been very fortunate. Again, luck comes into this again. I got lucky. Yeah.
As you all know, the Success Story podcast is part of the HubSpot podcast network, which has incredible podcasts for entrepreneurs, business leaders, people just wanting to upskill themselves. One of my favorites that you need to go check out is My First Million, hosted by Sam Parr and Sean Puri. They have incredible guests, Alex Hormozi, Sophia Amoruso, Hassan Minhaj, all sharing their secrets, how they made their first million, and how to apply their learnings to capitalize on today's business trends and opportunity. Go listen to My First Million wherever you get your podcast. No, I think that, you know, I'm just uncovering things that make you successful as you speak more. And I think that one of the things that was actually a benefit, you not coming from a business background, is this almost this insane obsession with the customer to a detriment in some cases, but ultimately, like, that mindset has allowed you to differentiate yourself, whereas some people probably wouldn't have gone that far, stopped short, cut off a project, whatever, delivered half-assed results, and then, you know, you don't build the 15-year-plus relationships. That's what I'm seeing. And that's something that,
Yeah. I think that's maybe that is. I hadn't actually thought about it in terms of that approach or that thought process being a result of where I came out of. I probably should have thought about that for the book.
No, you can do. Listen, man, you can do another one.
maybe I'll write an addendum.
Exactly. No. Listen. It's always the people that succeed the most are not the Stanford or the Harvard MBAs. They have their spot, but mm-hmm. I believe that people that come from different circumstances have an edge, whether or not it's a chip on their shoulder or they came from nothing or they came from a totally different lifestyle. They look at things differently. I think that somebody that goes into something saying this is the way it's always been done is the death of business. I always find that.
Yeah. I think that's, I think there's an up and a downside to it. I mean, I do think sometimes, you know, my lack of a business background or sort of business sense has kept me from building a much bigger enterprise. But at the end of the day, yeah. All our clients, including the largest corporations we work for, they say things like, look, we're excited because you're small, because you're a tailored business, right? We can always go to a large, you know, 2,000 person company. But so I think, you know, that actually has worked in our favor to stay relatively small and sort of provide this tailored approach to every client we deal with. So it's been that's been interesting. But I think if you don't find new challenges when you get out of an environment like the agency or the military. Look, I know a lot of wonderful folks coming out of the military and it can be, that transition can be super tough, right? Particularly if you were in, you know, some high speed operations, but you have to be able to find that next challenge that keeps you moving forward or that provides that next opportunity to grow. And if you don't, then that's when trouble can set in.
You know, it's interesting. You keep mentioning your lack of basically business acumen, but yet you've built a successful company. You work with Fortune 50, Fortune 100, and you've probably marketed yourself a hell of a lot better than a lot of the people with 2,000 person plus companies. Like, how many of their CEOs have been on Rogan and Patrick David's podcast? And I'll throw myself in the mix, even though I'm not on that level yet. But right. I mean, but you know, so I'm seeing you're doing something. So what do you think? Consciously or maybe now subconsciously as you're just thinking through, what do you think differentiated you when it came to building the business, building a personal brand, marketing yourself? Because all this, and then, I mean, you're on TV too. You've done some very strategic things that anybody else coming out of the agency, anybody else coming out of the military, FBI, even police force, they have a story to tell. CIA, you know, it's a little bit sexy, but I mean, FBI is sexy. You're up high enough in the military, you do some cool shit, that's sexy too. You can build a brand around that. What made you different?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and some people have, and they've done it very well. You know what, I kind of blundered into, if we just took at the media appearances, if you just talk about doing talking head appearances for the news on national security issues or counterterrorism or whatever the topic may be. I kind of blundered into it. It was, I had moved from London to the East Coast to set up an office. We had just taken our first investors and they, BGR, which is a fantastic lobbying firm in Washington, D.C. And so part of the agreement for the investment was open an office there with them, co-locate. And at the time, we were starting to build up a presence in Iraq, and this was early 2003, so very beginning of our first incursion there. But we had been dealing with some of the infrastructure companies. And so the point of this story is, one day, Ed Rogers, great guy, terrific individual, part of BGR and the original founding partners, he came walking to my office, knocked on the door and said, hey, Fox News needs somebody to talk about Iraq. You know, head over there. It'll be fun. You got to be kidding me. So I made a couple of calls. They said, sure, you know, don't talk about anything stupid, but you can do it. And the agency's always been good with me that way. But so I went over, did the appearance and found out after the first couple that, you know, honestly, as long as you don't say anything stupid, you don't fall off your chair. Right. You know, the news networks need to fill up a lot of time. And I just happened to have a lot of, you know, experience and background in certain areas, and was willing to go on and talk about that. And so some of the outlets, including Fox, they were very good. You know, they were very good to me, and they were. And then I discovered that I wasn't getting paid for any of it. But what they would do is they would put the company name on the bottom, like, you know, with the company. And once I realized that, then we were off to the races. Because like I said earlier, there was no way we could have, as a startup, afforded that sort of marketing. It just wasn't going to happen. And so, you know, I realized that, you know, that was an edge, right? We had an opportunity there. And then everything else just sort of kind of fell into place, I suppose.
No, I was going to say, it's amazing how, you know, to have a good story, you just have to have a cool career, do something incredible, and then speak about it. But you'd be surprised at how many people just don't feel comfortable leaning into that. And then you did. Now it's
Yeah, I mean, I think the agency, again, because of what I was doing in operations, and you know, you do have a sometimes an overblown sense of confidence. and, you know, so I think that that part of it never, and I genuinely like talking about issues of the day. I spend a great deal of time focused on that. I have a lot of friends in a lot of different places, and we end up, you know, banging on about, you know, the current crises.
There's never a shortage of them. So
there's never a shortage, and so it helps if you find it all interesting, right? You can't fake that part of it. It's like, but I think luck kind of fell into it again, and then, you know, once I realized that it was certainly beneficial, you know, it wasn't like I was going to turn down opportunities.
Yeah, no, obviously. Another one of the rules that you mentioned, which I thought was interesting, it just in terms of velocity and getting shit done, it's number four. It's get off the X.
Yeah.
What does that mean exactly? Where does that come from in an agency context? And then how does that translate into business, startup, entrepreneurship?
Well, in an operational sense, you know, not just the agency, but the military and other organizations, the X means is essentially an ambush site. So, I mean, A, you don't want to be on the ambush site to begin with.
Yeah, fair.
So
okay.
The idea is you spend a lot of time training to recognize indicators of a potential ambush. Right? And, you know, but if you do get on the X, if you're unfortunate and for whatever reason you land on that spot, then you have to be able to get off the X. You have to get out of there, right? And in operational terms, that's a tough thing because everything starts locking up, right? And you start, you know, getting blinders and, you know, your hearing goes, and, you know, in any difficult situation, right, you have to start relying on big muscle memory. And so that's, again, why training is so important, why, you know, it's not enough just to do, you know, some training. You have to constantly review it. But anyway, the point is, in business, what it means is, I think anyway, in my opinion, this is what, again, you know, there's no hard and fast, I suppose, to any of this, but from my perspective, it simply means knowing how to make decisions quickly with imperfect information, right? Because once you land in the shit from an operational perspective, right, you just gotta take action, right? You don't have time to sit around and hope that you get all the data, where are all the hostile elements? What the hell is happening? You have to start making decisions, right? And it's the same in business, right? If you wait for all the data sets to come in, if you wait for all the analysis to be done on whatever it may be, something bad's going to happen, right? Or the competition's going to have your lunch, or you're going to lose the opportunity, or your reputation's going to be damaged, whatever it might be. So it really comes down to how do you, learn to, and also a lot of this is about how do you impart that ability to your personnel, to all the folks that are working with you, to make these decisions, again, with imperfect information.
And so when you're making these decisions with imperfect information, as a CEO, is that just being a leader for a period of time, or is there actual practice that you can do to make sure that when shit hits the fan, you don't screw it up?
Yeah, there's a lot to this. It's part of it is not that complicated. Part of it is, knowing your risk appetite, which is another element of.
I was actually curious about that one too, only because I thought that business inherently comes with risk. So how do you not have a risk appetite if you're building something?
Well, you'd be surprised. And even, I mean, going back to, you know, the Intel community, look, Intel organizations, which, you know, by definition are risk-taking operations, they go through periods of time where they become risk averse, right? It's because, you know, they've had blowback from, you know, some operation, or they've gotten their ass kicked up on Capitol Hill too many times.
Yeah.
And so, you know, suddenly you've got a cycle where, you know, management is avoiding risks. And I've seen a couple of those cycles sweep through the agency over the years, and that's a bad thing. Yeah. But you have to understand what, and when you're understanding what your risk appetite is, it also means you have to understand what your shareholders or your investors or your board of advisors' risk appetite is. You have to understand what the client's risk appetite is, for sure, when you're talking about, you know, working for them and providing, you know, strategic intelligence or guidance or due diligence or whatever it may be. And, you know, that's a key part of it. And that informs a lot of other decisions that you make, including how do you, you know, again, make decisions with imperfect information.
Another, you know, when you're talking about risk appetite, I'm interested because you deal with businesses that are dealing with threats. So in a business landscape, advice for executives, CEOs, founders, what are the threats that you see really plaguing businesses right now? And I know there's, you know, there's specific examples that would not transcend every industry or every category, but you see macro level, what are some things that people should think about?
Well, I think any company of any size, and it doesn't really matter how big it is, because small businesses can be damaged quicker and faster and, you know, more broadly than large corporations at times from some of these. But the insider threat is always something that we end up talking about. And the insider threat can mean a variety of things, right? It can mean within a pharmaceutical company, you've got somebody who has been recruited, developed by a competitor to provide intellectual property or key information regarding research and development. It could mean they could have been compromised by Chinese intelligence service, right? I mean, that sounds, oh my God, that's spooky, but look.
Yeah.
You know, that's happened to Dow, it's happened to DuPont, it's happened to a wide variety of companies, right? Where state-sponsored intel services have targeted the private sector, gone after individuals who they've identified through the typical recruitment process or recruitment cycle, and just like an intel service would, and go after these individuals who can provide then inside information, economic espionage, basically. So that is, and so that's an example of an insider threat. You know, insider threat can also be, you know, a disgruntled employee who decides, you know, to do enormous damage because perhaps they work in IT or wherever they may have access to very sensitive information. It could be an accounting issue and finance. So the insider threat is something that companies need to be focused on. Cybersecurity is obviously a big buzzword and has been for a while. And that is a whole separate, you know, conversation in terms of the ability of companies to understand what those threats are, to stay on top of those threats, to understand how to respond, when to incorporate outside law enforcement assistance. The FBI is working very hard now to try to establish better dialogue with the private sector so that they can better inform the private sector where these threats are coming from. And it's just the potential for damage to a company. When we talk about, and you mentioned it early on, when you talk about like within operations or within the agency, failure to do the right thing can lead to, you know, death or serious, you know, goat rope. Then, you know, I think with the private sector, you know, you're talking about the crushing of a company. You're talking about the, you know, irreparable damage to a brand. You're talking about, you know, massive losses, layoffs. I mean, there's all sorts of damage that can be done through companies not paying attention. I mean, look, you know, SVB, Silicon Valley Bank, probably not the best example of like that sort of insider threat. That seemed more like it was a bunch of tools trying to make decisions that were completely inappropriate. So, you know, you also have to worry about the insider tool threat, apparently.
By the way, I know we booked this till three. I was just gonna ask a few more, then we'll wrap up quick if that's okay. Sure. If you don't have like a hard stop in four.
No, of course.
When you actually go into a company like this, or any size, actually, well, I'd ask, like, what would you recommend somebody who's listening to this? You know, they have a workforce of 100 or 5,000. How would you even start to approach that? How could they start to approach that? Just look for red flags to know if they should even work with somebody like you. What's the canary?
I mean, it depends on the size of the business. Most corporations of any size obviously have internal, you know, security departments. They may view them differently. I mean, some companies, it's interesting, even no matter how large they are, they view their security element as physical security, and that's pretty much it, right? And you know, access controls and you know, CCTV and, you know, badges, and, you know, it's a very old school way of viewing security. Others are much more advanced. They're proactive about understanding the importance of a chief security officer, and how they work with the chief compliance officer. The smartest ones, where they have operations overseas, they typically have international risk groups within their company that analyze the potential threats and try to understand, you know, down the road, not just the immediate threat, because you got to keep looking down the road, because everything changes. And so I guess one of the biggest problems sometimes that we see when you're talking about how the company or the C-suite interacts with the security side of things, information security, personnel security, strategic understanding of threats that exist to the business, is that there's an indirect reporting line. If I was running a corporation of any size, I would want those individuals, the chief compliance, the chief security officer, the head of your cyber security, you know, element, your IT personnel, I would want them in my office on a constant, regular basis, briefing me and me asking questions and having a conversation with them. So you want direct reporting lines there. And oftentimes that's not the case, and it's sort of filtered, and they don't, and it's a reflection of how they view the importance of security or information. And our perspective is always, whoever's got the best intelligence, whether it's the intelligence about the existing threats to their company or the potential threats, whether it's intelligence about how their competition is creating unlevel playing fields, you have to understand the value of information. And that can be a difficult thing because, you know, again, they look at security and they look at the internal intel group as cost centers, right?
Yeah.
And that's, nothing's further from the truth. Those elements within these companies are not only saving potentially vast sums of money, but they're creating opportunities for them, right? By their ability to understand and process and analyze and disseminate information to the C-suite so they can make better strategic decisions.
No, I would say that I would assume, unfortunately, that a lot of these organizations only start taking these groups seriously when something happens in retrospect.
That's very well put. That's much more eloquent and concise than I just banged on about for 10 minutes.
No, I have no doubt. Yeah. I have no doubt. They only care when again, shit hits the fan.
Yeah.
Which is
the worst. That's typically when, with due diligence as an example, right?
Yeah.
Best way to protect your business is to do thorough due diligence. Now, due diligence isn't sexy. It's not exciting, right?
Yeah.
But it's also not a heavy lift. It's not costly, right? But yet we see time and time again, we see companies that are like, hey, you know, we don't want to spend, you know, some small amount to do due diligence properly, thoroughly, on a, you know, $100, $200, $300, $400 million investment, whatever it may be, right? Because, it's a cost center. Do we really want to spend that money? You know, Bob worked with Todd, you know, 20 years ago. He knows him. He's a good guy. Now he's at this. You see that, you know, constantly. I mean, look at FTX, right? Sam Bankman-Fried. Yeah. You know, look at, you know, Madoff, right? Some simple due diligence would have informed a lot of people and kept people from getting hurt.
Well, did you see that? You see that JP Morgan suing that company for 100-some million because whatever their entire customer base is fake? Did you see this story?
Yeah. I know. Go figure. Well, I mean, but look, it's you have to be. If you're running a business, right, small, medium, large, doesn't matter, you got to ask the questions all the time, right? Never take, I mean, look, KPMG is probably going to get their knickers in a twist because they signed off on SVB and Signature, I think. You know, as audits shortly before, I think within a couple of weeks of everything heading south. So, you know, that's a major, well-regarded operation, signing an audit, you know, off, and then you've got this problem. So clearly people weren't asking the right questions and, you know, taking the time to actually conduct the proper level of due diligence. So we're big fans with my company of due diligence. Again, not exciting, not sexy. It's not a big investigation that you can, you know, oh, look at that. But you've got a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it, you know, it saves you most often the big heavy costs of an investigation when everything, you know, heads south.
Yeah. So, you know, and just to wrap up this sort of the security and best practices discussion, what do you recommend for companies to sort of stay ahead of the curve looking forward? What are they looking at? What are they researching? What are they paying attention to that you've seen have a major impact that they really have to, you know, focus on?
Yeah. Again, depending on their, you know, their areas of operation, what jurisdictions they're working in, and the size of the company. I mean, that can change. But it's a great question because it kind of points back to sort of that idea of know your operating environment, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to understand, and this takes a while, right? And whether you use internal resources or you have to go outside to get it done, you know, you have to understand where you're operating, what those jurisdictions are doing, what the regulations look like, what the governments in those areas, if you're working overseas, what they're doing, what their stability looks like, what's going to happen. I got great relations with a company or with a country now, but, you know, elections are coming up. Who should I know in 2 or 3 years? I got to build a network there. So there's a lot of little things, knowing what your competition is engaged in, particularly, again, if you're operating overseas, because, you know, typically it's not a level playing field out there. And then you need to, you know, understand even small businesses, you know, need to pay attention to the bigger issues, right? Like the banking industry, right? You gotta focus, right? This is not just about SVB and Signature going down. This is a bigger issue, right? So you have to start being proactive about gathering information and understanding it, and then using that information to make smarter decisions going forward, 2 or 3 or 4 years down the road. Like you said, you have to look forward. You can't just sit and stare at what you're doing currently.
What is, now let's bring it back just to close out with your experience building a business. What's the one thing that you really fucked up when you were building a business? That's the lesson for entrepreneurs. Like, what's that thing that you, I know you think of something the second I say that. So what is it? Probably many, but
you know what? It's probably not having my wife run the business earlier on, right? Now I'm teamed up because we went and
I love that.
We managed essentially a buyout a couple years ago from our last investors. And so I merged it with my wife's crisis communications and policy firm. And I've completely outpunted my coverage, right? I mean, she is far smarter than I am. So when you say, what's the one thing I should have done? I should have asked Em to run the business years ago.
There's a lesson there. There's definitely a lesson there.
She's much better at it than I am. But other than that, you know what? You live and learn. I don't know. I don't think there was anything else that existed. I've been very fortunate with the people that we've hired and that I've had a chance to work with. I can't really whine about anything.
No, that's good. That's a blessing. But you know what? That's a lesson in and of itself, like hiring the right people. Listen, not everyone has a wife that can take over, but you do have a CEO or something that can probably take over and do some stuff better than you too. So that's a good lesson. Okay, if people want to get this book, what's this book for? Who's this book for? Who's going to benefit from this? Where can they get it? And then also social for you. Where do you want people to go? Website, all that stuff.
No, thank you very much for that. It's called Company Rules. It's on Scribd, S-C-R-I-B-D, which is, again, the Netflix of books. So you go to the Scribd app. You can download Company Rules. It's an audio book. I narrate it myself. So it's almost as soothing as listening to Morgan Freeman, who was busy and couldn't do it. But I think it's for, honest to God, when I look at it, And during the course of writing it, the rules are great, I think, for anybody who's in business, right? It's not, and it doesn't matter whether you got five people or you got 5,000 people, because what I find anyway, I'm subjective, is they seem applicable across the board. And then it's also what I've realized, a lot of these things are the same things I tell my kids, right? So it may be applicable. I may have written a parenting manual, is what I'm saying.
It's not that different.
Exactly. Anybody running a business knows it's you know, sometimes it's not that different. But anyway, and then as far as social goes, I got the whole Twitter thing. It's at MB Company Man. At MB Company Man. And awesome. So yeah, that's where we're at.
Perfect. Okay, and the last question I ask everyone, you sort of had, you've had two lives, you've had agency life, then entrepreneur life. After everything, what does success mean to you?
You know what? That I raise healthy, productive, loyal, humor-filled, honest, hardworking kids, and that they are above average. I tell them all the time, my job and Emily's job, we're not here to raise average people. So if we can achieve that, then everything else is kind of a bonus.
Introducing WonderSuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the WonderSuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise, and with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I know a lot of entrepreneurs listen to this show, and NetSuite has been a huge supporter for entrepreneurs, for business owners, because there's one thing that we all know. Business is about making money, and it's about your bottom line. And the less you spend on the nuts and bolts of running your business, the more profits you keep. But these days, everything is costing more. Supplies, people, shipping. It squeezes your margins, and I've been there, juggling multiple systems for finance, inventory, you name it. Each with its own costs and its own set of headaches. That's why I made the switch to NetSuite by Oracle. It's changed our company. Think about it. NetSuite is one of the top financial systems out there. It puts your whole business on one platform, accounting, finance, the works. One data source for everyone. There's no more mismatched info. And because it's in the cloud, it slashes your IT costs. No more servers, no more updates. Just access NetSuite from anywhere. With one integrated suite, your overhead drops big time. And here's the real win. Efficiency. Everything's connected in NetSuite. Costs are ridiculous lately. Find a proven way to reduce your expenses and get better performance out of your team. It's a no-brainer, and that's what NetSuite offers. Over 37,000 companies have figured this out already. You have to join them. Right now, through to April 15th, NetSuite's got an incredible, flexible financing plan. Check it out and see the savings yourself at netsuite.com/ScottClary. That's netsuite.com/ScottClary. I don't know about you, but the idea of being harassed, scammed, or even worse, all because somebody found my personal information online, that's terrifying. Our political opinions, our addresses, even stuff about our families, it's out there for anyone to grab. And did you know that data brokers are allowed to sell information on over 98% of Americans? It's scary stuff. That's why I've partnered with Delete Me. I personally use Delete Me. They're a big friend of the podcast because I put myself out there online. So safety is a huge concern. It's really scary how easy it is to find someone's details and information, but DeleteMe creates a layer of protection that we all need. You tell DeleteMe what you want gone, and they make it disappear from those sketchy data broker sites. And DeleteMe doesn't stop. They constantly monitor the web to keep your information off those lists. It's like having a privacy watchdog that never sleeps. You need to take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for DeleteMe. They're giving a special discount for all Success Story podcast listeners. Get 20% off your DeleteMe plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/success and use promo code success at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/success and enter code success at checkout. joindeleteme.com/success. Hey everyone, I just want to take a second and thank the sponsor of today's episode, Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond Bourbon. Now, I don't have a lot of liquor sponsors on this show. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is actually one of my favorites. I've drank it for a few years now, and this is why we actually decided to work together. Heaven Hill Distillery, family-owned since 1935, is a great entrepreneur story too. So there's five brothers. They filled their first whiskey barrels back in 1935, and their legacy still lives on today. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is aged over 7 years. That's three more than required by the Bottled and Bond Act of 1897. This means the best quality, the best purity, and the best consistency. This is not just average bourbon. It's the winner of the double gold medals at multiple 2023 World Spirits competitions, and they've won the very prestigious Triple Still Award. It's a very big deal in the liquor and bourbon world. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond boasts an exceptionally smooth oak flavor, while its aroma offers a sweet blend of caramel and smooth vanilla. If you love bourbon, you need to try Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond. Available nationally, look for a bottle at your local store. Heaven Hill reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely. Think back to your last few days in the office. Did any of them leave you feeling really accomplished? Not the kind of day where you're running around like crazy, but where you've made real progress on something that matters. Because being busy doesn't always mean being productive, and I bet you we've all been there, and maybe it's time to rethink what it means to get things done. Today's episode is sponsored by Belay, and what they help you do is, instead of getting sucked into emails and to-do lists, they help you delegate tasks and focus on big goals. They can connect you with top-notch US-based talent who are ready to take on those time-consuming tasks that bog you down. Let's be real, there are way more important things you could be doing than bookkeeping or wrangling a packed inbox. They have virtual assistants to handle all of those pesky administrative tasks, or accounting professional to take care of all your financials. But here's the best part. You don't have to waste weeks searching for the right person. Belay's personalized matching service works quickly, sometimes matching you with the right talent to take stuff off your plate in under a week. Are you ready to try a different way of working? Check out Belay's list of the top 25 things you can delegate to a virtual assistant. It might just change your business and your life. Text SUCCESS, that's SUCCESS, to 55123 to get the list and to start transforming your to-do list with Belay. Thank you so much, Indeed, for sponsoring Success Story. For all business leaders out there, Indeed is a lifesaver. See, we're always driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. You're going to ditch the busy work and you're going to use Indeed for scheduling, screening, messaging, so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Clary. Just go to Indeed.com/Clary right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Clary. Terms and conditions apply. If you need to hire, you need Indeed.